From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we meet two of the survivors from the USS Indianapolis. The ship torpedoed in the Philippine Sea in 1945. Nearly 900 men were cast into the water. Only 317 survived hypothermia, dehydration, and shark attacks. The story of the Indianapolis has become a legend and the center of a controversy. We'll talk with Paul Murphy, chairman of the Indianapolis Survivors Association, and his old shipmate, Harold Bray. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A Navy hearing has decided the fate of Commander Scott Waddell. He commanded the Navy submarine that smashed into a Japanese fishing vessel, killing 9 people. NPR's Andy Bowers is covering the story in Hawaii.
The commander of the Pacific Fleet has declined to court-martial Commander Scott Waddell and has instead subjected him to what's called an admiral's mast. This is a non-judicial proceeding in which the admiral can hand down the punishment that he feels appropriate within limits. The punishment, according to Waddell's lawyer, is a letter of reprimand and an agreement that Commander Waddell will step down, will retire from the Navy by October 1st. And that date is significant because next month Waddell reaches his 20-year mark in the Navy, and that means that he will receive his full pension. But of course, his Navy career is over, and it's a career that was a rather promising one before this accident.
NPR's Andy Bowers in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The White House is questioning whether a Peruvian pilot followed the rules of engagement before shooting at a plane carrying American missionaries. Last Friday's attack killed an American woman and her baby daughter. An American drug surveillance plane had asked the Peruvian Air Force to see if the plane had filed a flight plan. When the Peruvians said they couldn't find a flight plan, a Peruvian jet was sent up to intercept the small plane. Peruvian Air Force officials say their pilot did follow proper procedures, which include trying to make radio and visual contact with the suspect plane, then firing warning shots to force it to land. Volunteers and National Guard soldiers are piling sandbags along the Mississippi River at Davenport, Iowa. High waters have already flooded the local baseball stadium and several streets and businesses in the East Iowa town. NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Davenport.
There's just a day to go before the Mississippi River is due to crest at near record levels here in Davenport. And as that time edges nearer, this town of 100,000 people is racing to fortify the downtown core. Throughout the riverfront area, there are freshly made dikes and levees and miles of temporary river walls made of sandbags and plastic sheeting. Weather continues to hamper emergency efforts. Today, there are high winds of 40 miles an hour. Over the weekend, rain forced teams to work quickly to prevent dikes from collapsing. Davenport is the largest city on the upper Mississippi River without flood walls, and it depends on the dikes to escape widespread flooding. In 1993, the river swamped the historic downtown area, causing millions of dollars worth of damage. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Davenport, Iowa.
Stock prices fell today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 47 points to close at 10,532 in moderate trading of just over a billion shares. The Nasdaq lost 104 points, or 4.8%. This is NPR News. President Bush has reportedly decided not to allow the sale of an advanced destroyer-based weapons system to Taiwan. The Associated Press quotes officials as saying the president has turned down Taiwan's request for the Aegis weapons system, a highly advanced combat radar system. China objected strongly to the sale of the Aegis. The president has reportedly agreed to sell Taiwan a less advanced weapons package. Israel says it's considering a Jordanian-Egyptian initiative to end 7 months of violence and resume peace talks with the Palestinians. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinians say Israeli soldiers in the Gaza Strip shot dead a 12-year-old during a funeral procession. Israel's army denies the account, but witnesses say soldiers guarding a Jewish settlement fired into a crowd of mourners in the cemetery. They say the fire came after some Palestinians shot in the air, a routine ritual at Gaza funerals, and that Palestinians then fired back. Medical workers say at least 10 others were injured. In Israel, another bomb exploded near Tel Aviv, lightly injuring 8 people. Israeli police also say a man found dead in his trunk in the West Bank appears to have been killed by Palestinians. They speculate the Israeli was lost and entered a Palestinian area by mistake. Yasser Arafat repeated that he opposes attacks on civilians. Israel accuses him of doing nothing to prevent them. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Serbian Supreme Court has ordered a new trial for a group of Kosovo Albanians who'd been sentenced to long prison terms under the regime of former President Milosevic. The Albanians are to be freed tomorrow pending a new trial. The report didn't specify how many people would be released. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and the Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. The USS Indianapolis is one of the great and tragic stories of the sea, an epic of survival, heroism, and self-sacrifice. It's also a continuing controversy. Survivors believe their captain was unfairly blamed for the disaster, and they're still working to clear his name and to expose official blunders and cover-up. Near the end of the Second World War, the U.S. Navy sent the Indianapolis alone across the Philippine Sea, then failed to notice when the heavy cruiser never reached port. Torpedoes from a Japanese submarine sent the ship to the bottom in less than 15 minutes. About 900 men spilled into the water. Just 317 were still alive when rescue finally arrived 5 days later. I spoke with 2 Indianapolis survivors, Paul Murphy, who's now the head of the Survivors Association, and with his shipmate Harold Bray, who was asleep on deck when the torpedoes hit.
That was my first night on the topside. My regular sleeping quarters were three decks down forward around sick bay. And I don't know why I slept up there that night, but I'm glad I did.
And this was just at about midnight. Harold, did you realize that they were torpedoes at first?
Oh, no, sir. When I woke up, I looked up. I was underneath the number one and number two gun turret sleeping, and then when I woke up, I looked up and saw the fire coming out of the stack, number one stack. And I really did. I thought a boiler blew, or of course, being new in the Navy, I didn't know what could have happened. I never expected a torpedo.
You were 17 years old at the time.
Yes, sir.
And just in the Navy, it couldn't have been more than a few months.
Well, I enlisted in December of 1944, and I went into boot camp in January of 1945.
And so did you turn to somebody and say, you know, what's going on?
No, I had my dungarees on, no shirt on, and my shoes were off. So I reached for my shoes, and when I did, I saw them slip over the side or down to the lower deck or somewhere. But I was barefoot, and then I started to go down to my battle station, which was 3 decks down, and couldn't get down there on account of fire and smoke. So I continued aft through the port hangar deck. I got to the rear of the hangar deck, and there was somebody in the carpenter shop throwing out his life jacket, so I grabbed one and continued aft to the fantail.
Paul Murphy, you were asleep. Did the explosion of the torpedoes wake you up?
Yes. I was blown out of my bunk, and I quickly grabbed my clothes and shoes and dressed and went to my general quarters station, which was in the after part of the ship.
Now, at this time, was the alarm for general quarters going off around the ship?
No, there was no power to do anything on the ship. When the torpedoes hit, it knocked out all intercoms aboard ship.
And if there's no power, it's black.
That's right. It was pretty black. And I went to my general quarters station, which was the after control tower, and that was the tower that controlled the 8-inch guns. And when I opened that door up, a friend of mine from California by the name of Paul Mitchell was lying there sound asleep, and I woke him up, gave him a life jacket, and told him to go to his general quarters station. Later, I found out that Paul did get off of the ship, but he died about 2 or 3 days later. I never saw him in the water, however.
At that time, what did you think had happened?
Well, I knew something had hit us. Didn't know whether it was torpedoes or gunnery or what, but everything that happened was forward of where I was. I couldn't see that the bow had been blown off, nor that the second torpedo exploded under the number one turret. But the ship very quickly started listing to the starboard side.
Just turning over, starting to turn over.
Right, and when it reached about 40, 45 degrees, the 5-inch guns that were on the deck below where I was were covered with water. So when I left the ship, all I did was step off and swim with a life jacket on, and I had an extra one with me when I went over the side, and I swam probably 75 to 100 yards, looked back, and then I saw the ship completely turn over on its top, and the stern was standing straight up in the air with the propellers or screws still turning, and then it disappeared.
You could see that silhouetted against the stars?
Yes.
Harold Bray, we left you on the fantail with your life jacket.
Yes, well, when I got there, there was one of the sailors was hurt pretty bad, and I gave him my life jacket and went back and got another one. And by the time I got back to the fantail, whoever I gave it to was gone, and I was hanging on to the lifeline, and the ship was really listing badly at the time, so there was another sailor by the name, I can't remember his name, but we call him Frenchie, and he escaped from France, I guess, from the Germans, and joined our Navy to get into the war, and he kept saying, "You better go over, Bray, you better go." I said, "No, she's not going down." So finally I climbed over the lifeline, and by that time the mast was in the water. She was laying flat on her side, and I ran down the side of the ship back towards the quarterdeck, and that's where I went off. It was still about a 30 or 40 foot drop, and when I hit the water, somebody hit me and drove me down. I don't know how far I went down. But then I happened to open my eyes to come back up, and I see this big black spot. I said, "Oh, man, it's just coming down on top of me." But it happened to be oil slick on the water, and I came to the surface and started swimming away, and I wrapped my arm around a what they call a floater net. It was still bundled up. There was a sailor sitting on top of it, and we finally got that. Well, and I looked back, and
this would have been like a cargo net, but with cork in it.
Yes, it was like 1 foot square with cork, and it was like maybe I don't know. Maybe Paul would know the size. It was like maybe
about 10 by 20 or something.
Something like that, 24 foot squares, and well, before that, I looked back, and the ship was up on her bow and going down, and there were still guys coming off of it, falling. I don't know. That would be hundreds of feet when she was on her bow and coming down. And there were still guys coming off, like looked like a bunch of ants coming off of the ship.
What were you hearing at that time? What did it sound like?
A lot of banging, and there was a couple little explosions that something inboard of the ship was exploding. But as far as they always said, swim away from her, I never felt any suction or anything. I was only maybe 100 yards from her when she went under.
What group did you join when you went off the ship?
Well, when we went off at midnight, a little after midnight, there was oil slick on the water, and we all swallowed oil and salt water, and we've spent most of the night vomiting. We didn't know where we were that night because it was so dark, but we all were waiting forward to the sunrise the next day so we could gather around and determine where we were and what to expect. And the next morning, we found that there were 3 cargo nets in my group and 2 life rafts. And we tied those cargo nets together and eventually got the life rafts tied in there, too. So we were in the largest group that went together and tried to stay together.
Harold, when we last left you, you were on a cargo net with one other man.
Well, we unrolled it. We untied it somehow. I don't know. I can't remember how we did that, but I don't know if the other sailor had a knife or what, but we got it unraveled and floating out, and then we started picking up people that were around. And I don't remember where the raft came from, but we did tie up with a raft and a couple of more of the floater nets.
Paul Murphy, the sun comes up that first day. You realize, obviously, obviously the ship has sunk. There's a tremendous amount of injured men. And what do you think is going on? Are you talking to officers on the ship at that point?
No, there wasn't too many officers around. There was a couple of them that were trying to give us a hard time. But they didn't have any more training for this than we did. So what we tried to do is keep those rafts together. My division was a Fox division. We tried to take care of each other. We had quite a few of those boys together. And the ones that were put on the rafts were generally somebody that was injured pretty badly and needed to be out as much of the water as possible. Now, those rafts didn't protect you much from water because they had sides that were hemp rope, and they had a open platform on the bottom. So they were probably waist deep in the water, where the rest of us that stayed in our life jackets were shoulder height there at the beginning. But it was a major warship, and we were very optimistic that we would be missed, if not any later than the next day, because on Tuesday afternoon, we were due into Leyte, and surely they'd be looking for us by that time.
Leyte, the port in the Philippines, that was your destination.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, of course, each day passed, and it became very obvious that no one was looking for us. We saw planes fly over us every day, but they were up probably 20 or 25,000 feet. There was no way they could see us. We tried to buoy each other up, and we prayed, and we encouraged each other, and eventually we were spotted. But it was. There's no way that we can tell you exactly how bad it was. The way to find out is to talk to the men that picked us up. They could tell you. They were mentally alert and able to tell you exactly how we looked and what we appeared like and everything. But it was tremendous. And this was a beautiful ship. This was a famous ship. It was a flagship of the Fifth Fleet, and somebody's going to be looking for us. And each day we were more optimistic than the day before.
Harold Bray, somebody always organizes a sing-along.
Yeah. There wasn't much singing that I could remember.
They organized prayers.
Yeah, that's about it. But, I stayed pretty much to myself. I was brand new on a ship, as I told you before, and I went on board with maybe about 12 to 20 men from my boot company. And I didn't know Paul until we started using or having our reunions, and I got acquainted with most of the remainder of the crew. Out of my boot camp company, I think there was 4 of us survived the sinking, and today I think there's 2 of us left now. One is in a hospital in Milwaukee, and than there's me, so.
Harold Bray and Paul Murphy, shipmates on the USS Indianapolis, which was torpedoed and sunk in the South Pacific in 1945. Only 317 men survived the disaster. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Now let's continue our conversation with Harold Bray and Paul Murphy, who survived the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. Let me take you back, though, to that first day. You're full of optimism that within a few minutes you're going to see a plane looking for you or a ship come up over the horizon. Was it hot? Were you starting to experience at that point dehydration?
It got pretty warm during the day. But the oil, the fuel oil that we had on us protected us from those of us that didn't have shirts or pants or the oil protected us from the elements as far as the heat goes. But it got pretty cold at night, though. There's nothing to protect you from that.
Was it clear at night?
By the most part, it was after the sinking of the ship. That night was pretty dark, but we had breaks in the clouds where the moon would come out once in a while. But after that, as I remember it, it was pretty clear. You could see stars at night.
And again, the sound, were people praying? Were people talking to themselves?
Yeah, they did a lot of talking to themselves and a lot of praying. There wasn't much, I didn't have much conversations with other people, but we helped each other. I hung on to this, what turned out to be a Marine. We carried, I think it was, what was it, Paul, 78 Marines on there?
No, 39.
Oh, 39. Uh-huh. Well, anyhow, seven of them survived. I hung on to this one Marine for a couple of days. He was floating around with his mouth open, and he was getting pretty well bloated, and I tried to tie him to the net so he wouldn't float away, and I think I did that, but he disappeared the last night. I never did see him again, so he must have, the knot probably wasn't very good.
Paul Murphy, the heat during the day, you must have been at that point, you know, you couldn't wait for sundown.
Well, as the days passed and our condition weakened and we were acclimating ourselves to the salt water and the dehydration and so forth. But eventually the sun was so blistering during the daytime that it started affecting our faces especially. And most, a lot of the boys, including myself, I cut my shirt tail off, and of course Harold didn't have one, but I cut my shirt tail off and put over my head during the daytime. And it was so warm and tropical that we looked forward to the coolness of the night. And then when we got in the coolness of the night, it became so chilly that our teeth even chattered. We looked forward to the warmth of the sun the next morning, and that was continual. You know, it was 4 days before we were spotted, and each day our mouths were swelling. We had no water. We had no food. And eventually there was very little talking going on. And those that got to the point where they really needed some liquid would drink salt water. And I'm telling you, you've never seen anybody go berserk as you would somebody that drank salt water. It was worse than the worst alcoholic drunk that you've ever seen. You couldn't stand them to be near you because our skin was so sore, and they were thrashing and trying to get over or climbing onto the rafts and so forth. And it was terrible.
Harold Bray, the other thing, of course, that everybody remembers about the Indianapolis is the sharks. When was the first time you saw one?
The first day. They just came in droves. There wasn't one. There was a lot of them. And they were hitting the guys, no matter if they were singles or if you're in a group. They just hit whoever they could come up upon.
And remind us again, you're clinging to a net that's being held afloat mm-hmm. by cork, so you're,
yes.
The water's up to your shoulders.
All the time. Yeah, it got, like Paul said, it got so bad that you couldn't touch anything because your skin would roll off after 3 days. It was just, it was a pretty terrible sight.
And you know those fish are in there.
Yeah, they come back every day. They always were hungry, I guess. It was just a terrible sight to see somebody next to you get hit by one of those things.
When that happened, did they just go away? Were they grabbed and taken below?
Yes, most of them. Well, some of them would bob back up, but it wasn't all there.
Paul, was that your experience as well?
Well, you know, I came from Missouri, and I didn't know what sharks looked like. I thought they might be catfish or something. But the schools came around us, and generally we splashed and hollered, and they seemed to let us alone for a while. They bumped our legs and stuff like that. But, you know, I found that sharks do not like Irishmen. And so I was okay.
When you feel that bump, though, of one of those sharks in the water bumping your legs, I mean, your stomach's got to fall right through your body.
Well, we got to the point where it might not have mattered. We had to look at it sensibly. Are we going to be saved or are we not? And you got to prepare for mentally for what might happen. And I think many of us were ready either way that it went. Fortunately, we were lucky enough to be spotted, and rescues soon came, at least within 12 hours after that.
Harold Bray and Paul Murphy, survivors of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis during World War II. More of their story in the second half of the show. I'm Neil Conan. This is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Crown Business Books Division, publishers of The Customer Revolution, How to Thrive When Customers Are in Control by Patricia B. Siebold with Ronnie T. Marshak and Jeffrey M. Lewis. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, disaster and rescue. We continue our conversation with Paul Murphy and Harold Bray, survivors of the USS Indianapolis, which was torpedoed in the Philippine Sea during World War II.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, filling in for Terry Gross. Now let's get back to our conversation with Harold Bray and Paul Murphy, who survived the sinking of the USS Indianapolis during the Second World War. The ship was torpedoed and sunk by a Japanese submarine. Only 317 men survived the long ordeal that followed, fighting dehydration, hypothermia, and shark attacks. Harold Bray, Paul said earlier that he was getting more and more optimistic every day, that knowing that the ship would be missed when it didn't come into port in the Philippines and Leyte. Was that your feeling too, or you were off there more or less by yourself a little bit?
Yeah, I just listened to the conversations of the old salts that were there, and they all knew more than I did. So, see, I was on, we took, 15 days from San Francisco to where we got sunk, and we were in the water 5 days. So I was damn near in the water as long as I was on board ship. So that was my first trip out and my last.
We were lucky to have those newcomers like that with us, though, I'll tell you that.
Why was that?
Well, it gave us somebody to talk to encourage. They looked at some of the... I was only on the ship about a year and a half, but they look forward to talking to some of the older men, and those older salts were encouraging all the time. It was a good opportunity for them to show their seniority.
But you guys didn't have any, survival equipment, no lights, no flasks of water, no food, no nothing?
Nothing. Well, we had the raft that we had. I think they had a water jug, but it was empty or full of salt water or something, from what I gather. We didn't have any of that. I think there was a can of malted milk pills
tablets
or something, yeah. It was supposed to be in the kit in the raft, and whoever was supposed to take care of those, I guess, didn't get around to that raft. There was nothing but that malted milk pills or tablets that I saw, and they passed those out, but not much energy in those.
Harold, was there, as you've thought about it all these years later, was there one moment that sticks out where you really thought about giving it up?
Yeah, but the fourth day, I don't believe they would have found many if Gwen didn't come along on the fourth day. I don't think another day in the water, I doubt if they would have found too many of us.
I don't think anybody would have known what happened to the Indianapolis in another 24 hours.
Everybody was getting pretty wore out and weak.
But when that moment arrived, what were you thinking about?
I was thinking about probably at home.
Paul Murphy, was there a moment like that for you?
Well, I knew that I had reason to live, if it was all possible, because my mother was in the hospital back in Missouri. And I knew that if anything happened to me, it would probably be disastrous for her. I have three brothers, and I always told my brothers that I was mother's favorite. So I had no girlfriends or anything like that, but I did have family back home that I was concerned about. But I did act sensibly about our situation. I had reached a point where it didn't make any difference one way or the other. If it was to be okay, and if it wasn't, Lord help me. And he did.
When did you guys first realize that that help was on the way?
When we saw the airplane. You know what? I never did see Gwen.
Who's Gwen?
That was the pilot that found us.
He was a pilot of the PVC-1.
Yeah.
It was a two-engine bomber out looking for submarines. That's a story in itself, Neil. Mm-hmm. You want me to elaborate a little bit on it?
Please.
Chuck Gwynn has always been called our angel. As he was approaching our area, they were testing a radio antenna out the bottom of the plane, which gave them longer distance to their home base. And just before he got to our area, one of the cables that this was suspended from became loose and it flopped around in the air. The pilot, Chuck, came back to the plane, got down on his belly, looked through the hole in the plane, and was intending to correct this antenna, but he saw oil slick in the water. And as he was approaching, he thought it was a Japanese submarine that might be in trouble, and he ran back to his seat and opened the bomb bay doors up and was making a bombing run on that area. And then as he became lower in altitude, approximately 2,000 feet, his crew saw heads bobbing in the water, and they realized that there was a disaster of some sort. And he immediately wired back to his base, and that message went to the sub-commander of the base, and he sent one PBY out with supplies.
That was the old Catalina plane.
Yes. And then as he got out to our area, which took probably an hour and a half to 2 hours, he started dropping supplies and life rafts and kegs of water and so forth. And his crew also saw that the men were scattered out over about a 25-mile area, and that especially those that were stragglers or off by themselves were being attacked by sharks. He wired back to his base in Peleliu, and they sent one more PBY out. So we had two of them flying over us. The first one that was out there was flown by Adrian Marks from Frankfort, Indiana, and he decided that in order to save some lives, he would have to break Navy regulations and land in 8 to 12-foot swells and start picking up the men. The other pilot was directing him as Marks landed, popped some rivets, and as he was approaching the various stragglers, which he decided was the best to do for the situation, the other one directed him from the air, and he started picking up survivors, and he picked up 56 men in a small plane like that, piled them in the aisle like cordwood, tied the rest of them on the wings with parachute shrouds, and that was the first time they found out that the USS Indianapolis had sunk, and nobody was looking for it. And Adrian Marks did one other rule breaking. He radioed all ships in the area his location, told them to proceed at once to pick up survivors. Didn't say who it was. And the ships then started coming in on late Thursday afternoon and didn't arrive there until after dark. But the Doyle was the first one on the site, and it had its lights, searchlights shining against the clouds, so that everybody knew help was on the way. And then the Bassett was the next ship on the scene, and it started up picking up the groups that Harold and I were in. And they picked up 151 men and took us to Samar in the Philippines for the hospitals. And before we got there, two of those men died en route. That was terrible. And they were later buried on Samara.
Harold, as Paul just mentioned, you were in that big group. Did you get that last day some of the supplies that were dropped from the air? And what were your feelings?
Backing up to Chuck Gwynn, when he spotted us, he dropped what I thought was a canister of water. And I left the group, and I swam out to it, and it was an antenna. It was a submarine detector. And just before Chuck died a couple years ago, he told me that I could have talked to him. There was a microphone on the end of this wire going down to the ocean.
It was a sono buoy. It was good to pick up the sound of a submarine.
Right. And when I did that, it was I don't know how far away I swam from the group, But at that time, I looked back, there was all kinds of noise going on, so I thought they were being hit by sharks. So there was another raft off, I don't know, another 100 yards or so from where I was. There was two guys on it. So I went over to that one. And I don't know, I sort of remember them taking this raft apart and trying to make a sail or something and sail away into the shipping lanes or some kind of stuff. Anyhow, I got on this raft, and there was no bottom in it because they had tore the slats out trying to make a sail. And sometime during the night, these two guys disappeared. I don't know what happened to them. I never did see them again. But I was alone on the raft when I got picked up by the Bassett. I think I was probably the first one that the Bassett picked up and put me on a LCV, or it was a landing craft anyhow, that came out and picked me up.
And, yeah, they use those like life...
like lifeboats.
Like lifeboats. Yeah. I think there was two or three of them out there circulating around and picking up boys, and then they'd come alongside the ship.
And when you got on the ship, was the first thing that you wanted a drink of water?
Well, the first thing they did for us, they put me in one of those basket things, you know, on the ship. The water was kind of rough, as I remember it. And this LC landing craft would go down, and the ship would go up, and then they'd jerk you up in this basket. That was a wild ride. They got me on then they put me on some kind of a operating table, and I thought this was a hospital ship or something. And there's questions like, you got any broken bones, and they checked you out. And then the next thing I knew was I was in the shower all cleaned up. I don't know how that happened, but everybody worked on you, I guess.
Paul, obviously by that point, a lot of the men were in very bad shape, delirious.
Yes, the crew can attest to that. I know when I came alongside the ship, they pulled me aboard this landing craft, and I thought I could climb the rope ladder, and I got up a couple of rungs, and I fell off, and they put me in this wire basket that Harold was referring to. It took me up to the quarter deck, and they laid me out on the deck and cut off my clothes because we were black, just covered with oil, and they cut off my clothes, and somebody carried me into the shower, and they laid me on the floor or deck in the shower, and we scrubbed the oil off of us the best they could. And the crew gave up their bunks. And I'm telling you, they were all nice white bunks. And it was a beautiful ship. And they threw us up on their bunks. And we left them in a mess. And they started giving us a little water and some oranges. The best tasting oranges I have ever had in my life.
Paul Murphy and Harold Bray of the USS Indianapolis Survivors Association. More of their story after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Harold Bray and Paul Murphy tell one of the most dramatic stories of disaster, survival, and rescue at sea, the USS Indianapolis. There seemed to be a period after the war when this story was not mentioned. I know the Navy was, well, at least according to what a lot of people believe, covering up the story and the responsibility and who was at fault for the ship being there and who was at fault for not knowing it had gone down. And really, that's another story. But you guys amongst yourselves, were you telling the story? Was this something that you lived with, or was it something you tried to forget?
May I answer that?
Go ahead.
I think most World War II veterans, when they came home, they were visiting with classmates and friends at home that had been in the service. And you couldn't tell whether you were talking to somebody that had it worse than you, so you kept your mouth shut. We never talked about it. We wanted to forget it. It wasn't until we started our reunions in 1960 that our camaraderie came together and we started talking about it. My own children never knew anything about it until about 1980.
Harold Bray, you worked as a police officer. Didn't it ever come up?
Oh, yeah, well, it was kind of a funny thing. We were in the coffee room one day. I never mentioned it to any of the guys. And my best golf buddy now, he was in the radio room or the coffee room that day. And we were talking about this movie, The Jaws. And they were talking about it, and I was just listening. And this buddy of mine, Bob, says, boy, that was a hell of a story this guy told. He mentioned the Indianapolis and the sharks and stuff. I said, well, I was on that ship. He said, no way. Then that's how they found out that I was on the ship.
A lot of people became familiar with the story of the Indianapolis from the movie Jaws. We have a clip from that movie. If you'll remember, this is the actor Robert Shaw, is the great shark hunter, and he's out in the water. He's got Richard Dreyfuss and Roy Scheider there as the chief of police from Amity. And he describes his experience and his animus for sharks because he was a crew member of the USS Indianapolis.
Japanese submarine slammed two torpedoes into our side, Chief. He was coming back from the island of Tinian to Lady and just delivered the bomb. The Hiroshima bomb. 1,100 men went into the water. Vessel went down in 12 minutes. Didn't see the first shark for about half an hour. Tiger, 13-footer. You know that when you're in the water, Chief? You tell by looking from the dorsal to the tail. What we didn't know was our bomb mission had been so secret. No distress signal had been sent. They didn't even list as overdue for a week. Very first light, Chief. Sharks come cruising. So we formed ourselves into tight groups. You know, it's kind of like old squares in a battle, like you see in a calendar, like the Battle of Waterloo, and the idea was, shark comes to the nearest man, that man, he start pounding and hollering and screaming. Sometimes the shark go away. Sometimes he wouldn't go away. Sometimes that shark, he looks right into you, right into your eyes. You know the thing about a shark, he's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, he doesn't seem to be living until he bites you. And those black eyes roll over white, and then, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in and they rip you to pieces. You know, by the end of that first dawn, lost 100 men. I don't know how many sharks, maybe 1,000. I don't know how many men, they average 6 an hour. On Thursday morning, Chief, I bumped into a friend of mine, Herbie Robinson from Cleveland. Baseball player, bosun's mate. I thought he was asleep. Reached over to wake him up. Bobbed up and down in the water, it was like a kind of top. Upended. Well, he'd been bitten in half below the waist. Noon the fifth day, Mr. Hooper, Lockheed Ventura, so he swung in low and he saw us too. A young pilot, a lot younger than Mr. Hooper anyway, he saw us and he come in low. And 3 hours later, a big fat PBY comes down and start to pick us up. You know, that was the time I was most frightened, waiting for my turn. I'll never put on a life jacket again. So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out, and the Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945.
The date there at the end of that clip of Robert Shaw from the movie Jaws, the date is wrong. There are a few other facts in there that are wrong. Paul Murphy, you were one of the men who was actually in the water. Did he get it right in most ways?
He indicated that most of the men that died were died from shark attacks. Most of the men that died from exhaustion, hyperthermia, drinking salt water, and it's hard to estimate how many of them were killed by sharks, but there were some. There's no question about that. But as I said, sharks really don't like Irishmen, and they didn't have me in that group.
Harold Braid, after you heard your fellow officers talking about that movie, did you have any interest to go see it?
I never have watched it. I never have seen it. I've heard about it. I never went to see it, no. I didn't think I could sit there and watch it.
I was interested in that thing, though, that he said was that the most terrifying part was right at the end. I guess the fear that you might not get away.
It passed over or something. Yeah. It was a big chance. Like, I was by myself. It was just a miracle that they saw me, you know. I didn't have any lights or nothing on me. And they just come up on me. And they must have been coming into the group from that direction, and I was there. They could have passed me by very easy. They picked up several singles, guys that were by themselves. So. But just one of the lucky guys. I'm not even Irish. I'm Scotch, though. Pretty close.
More with Harold Bray and Paul Murphy after a break. This is Fresh Air. Now, the conclusion of our conversation with Harold Bray and Paul Murphy, who survived the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. There are a lot of controversies surrounding the events that happened after you guys were picked up, involving the captain, and whether there should have been a court-martial, whether he should have been convicted, and now about all of the efforts to clear his name and make sure that what really happened is what is in the official record books. That is one part of it. Is there a day that goes by, Paul Murphy, that you don't now think about what happened all those years ago?
Well, especially when I see planes fly over. I try to shut out as much as I can, but, you know, most of the survivors, thankfully, for the youth of today, the youth of today want to hear the story. And I think most of the survivors are on kind of a speaking tour. I know I speak to an awful lot of high school, middle school, even grade school kids. Service clubs like the Rotary Club, the Optimist Club, the Sonoma Club. So daily I'm prepared to give a talk about it. And I think it's healing, really, Neil. I think anybody that has a story to tell about World War II or Korea or any of the others, is the sooner they can talk about it, the better they're going to be off mentally and be able to have a healing. Put it to bed.
Harold Bray, you did not talk about it much.
No. My mother and dad died not knowing what I went through. I never did talk to them about it. Sometimes I wish I would have, but they never asked, so I never told them.
And your kids?
My kids, they've been to, well, they didn't know about it in their young life either. And they've been to a few of our reunions with me. At one time, I think we had the biggest group at the reunion. We had 22 people in my group. We have many reunions, too. We had one at Paul's place last summer, and that was, I think that was more gratifying. We got to meet, be more intimate with people, you know. And
what fundamentally is it that you guys share?
Well, the experience in itself was... But you know what? We don't talk about that when we're at reunions. We go places together and do things, and hardly ever. Just at the memorial service is about the only time that the sinking of the ship and the war is ever mentioned. It's more of a social thing anymore. Just to get together.
You know, we're learning more about each other this way. Yeah. It's kind of a friendly group that gets together, and we get a chance to meet in the hospitality room and discuss families and get better acquainted.
But in a way, also, isn't it that after going through an experience like that together, that you may not know what another man's family is or what his upbringing is or what he did after the war, but you're brothers.
Yeah, that's right.
That's pretty close. That's closer than brothers, I would think. You experience something that somebody else never has.
Paul Murphy, thank you very much for sharing your story.
You bet.
Paul Murphy is chairman of the Indianapolis Survivors Association. And Harold Bray, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for taking us time.
Harold Bray and Paul Murphy of the USS Indianapolis. Two books about this disaster are in print, Abandoned Ship by Richard Newcomb and In Harm's Way by Doug Stanton. We'll close with a Navy hymn. I'm Neil Conan.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a look inside the world's largest, most secretive, and powerful intelligence agency. We'll talk with James Bamford, author of Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency. He'll talk about the NSA's past secrets and news-breaking revelations about its present-day activities. Join us for the next Fresh Air.